Professor Strauss, Philosophy of Plato, Session 5, April 12, 1965.
Reminder of the context. Now, let me first. We came up to 312b6, I take it, and we will go on immediately after that brief reminder which I spoke. Now, I remind you of a few points. First of all, the dialogue consists of three parts. The first, the dialogue with a comrade, which is a report by Socrates on his conversation with Protagoras and on what led up to that conversation. Secondly, the conversation with Hippocrates, which is the only strictly private part of the Protagoras, leading up to Socrates' conversation with Protagoras. Socrates goes to Protagoras not only in company, I mean the company of Hippocrates, but also on Hippocrates' behalf. And we are in this section. Socrates had shown to Hippocrates that becoming a pupil of Protagoras differs from his becoming a pupil of a physician or a sculptor, because Hippocrates will not become a pupil of Protagoras in order to become himself a sophist. He will go to Protagoras rather in the way in which he went to the teacher in reading and writing and so on. Namely, for the sake of education and not for the sake of acquiring an art which he would exercise and which would be the source of his livelihood. At this point we left off and we continue at 312b7.
I said, I wonder whether you know what you were doing. And what am I doing? You are going to commit your soul to the care of a man whom you call a sophist.
Yeah, a man here also emphasized an hombre. Yeah. And in the original, in Stronger, to an hombre, as you say, who is a sophist. Yes?
And yet, I hardly think that you know what a sophist is. And if not, then you do not even know to whom you are committing your soul, and whether the thing to which you commit yourself be good or evil. I certainly think that I do know, he replied.
I believe to know is a bit weaker. Yeah. I believe indeed to know. Yes?
Then tell me, what do you imagine a sophist is?
Yeah. Now, Socrates draws his attention here to the risk. That's a new consideration. Involved in handing over one's soul to a sophist. In other words, it's a much greater risk than to hand over, I do not know what, to one's teacher in reading and writing or in sitter play. The fact that Hippocrates wishes to go to Protagoras for the sake of education, as distinguished from a professional instruction, makes his wish not less dangerous than if he were to go to become a sophist. Hippocrates is of course sure that he knows what a sophist is. Now let us see whether he does know.
I take him to be one who knows wise things, he replied, as his name implies. And might you not, I said, affirm this of the painter and of the carpenter also? Do not they too know wise things? But suppose a person were to ask us, in what things are the painters knowledgeable? We should answer, in what relates to the making of likenesses, and similarly of other things. And if he were further to ask, in what branch of wisdom is the sophist knowledgeable, and what is the manufacture over which he presides, how should we answer him?
Now, that is not this. You will see here again a dialogue within the dialogue. This Socrates and Hippocrates are both asked the question, and both are supposed to answer it. Now, the two arts which I use as example, painting and house building. Painting is defined as a making of images. and the making of images is, of course, very important for rhetoric, if of a different kind of images. Building, however, is not defined. But one knows, builders built houses. And houses refer to the polis, to the city, consisting of houses, and therewith to the political art. So the relation of the rhetorical and the political art is here somehow implied. Now let us go on. But we understand the situation. The answer which Hippolytus has given is, of course, much too general. A sophist is a man, a knower of wise things. Wise things are sophia in Greek. Sophist belongs together. And this is naturally too general, because there are so many kinds of wise things. Yes?
How should we answer him? What other answer could there be but that he presides over the art which makes men eloquent?
Yeah, make men clever at speaking.
Yes, I replied, that is very likely true, but not enough. For the answer begs the further question, of what does the sophist make a man talk eloquently? The player on the lyre may be supposed to make a man talk eloquently about that which he makes him understand, that is, about playing the lyre. Is not that true? Yes. Then about what does the sophist make him eloquent? Must not he make him eloquent in that which he understands? Yes, that may be assumed. And what is that which the sophist knows and makes his disciple know? Indeed, he said, I cannot tell.
By Zeus, I can no longer tell. Yeah. Well, we see here he understands by a sophist a man who teaches you to become a good speaker. I.e., he identifies sophistry and rhetoric, which is in a way possible, as we have seen in the Gorgias, but in another way it doesn't suffice. The situation here is exactly like that in the Gorgias. The question is, clever in speaking about what? How can he make you clever in speaking about medicine if he doesn't teach you medicine? And is it possible at all to make a man clever in speaking without making him clever in the knowledge of a specific subject matter? This is exactly, only here is much briefer, because it was much easier to silence Hippocrates than Gorgias or Polus. Hippocrates doesn't know what history is, that's very clear, and yet he longs for it, and at the same time he rejects it. He himself would never wish to become a sophist. Now, the example is the sitar player, or the player on the player on the lyre. What does such a teacher teach? He teaches, of course, by means of words. But an art which produces not speeches, but wordless sounds, or as we can also say, meaningful silence. Yeah. I mean, because if it is not articulate language, one can call it silence. When he says here, Hippocrates, at the beginning of the passage just read by Mr. Reinken, what shall we say, Socrates, except that he knows to make one clever in speaking? It is not always possible to say, why does he say here, O Socrates, and not there? It is necessary to give some thought to it. The extreme cases which may clarify the situation are these. We know this from our own experience. When we talk, we do not frequently, do not all the time address the interlocutor by his name. We do it that has a special reason of emphasis. Now the extreme cases and the clearest cases are these. If he says something outrageous, and you want to bring him back to his senses, you say, but look, Mr. Miller. Or the opposite case, which happens especially to men like Socrates, that the interlocutor says that in order to kind of cry for help. Stop, stop. Yeah. When he is embattled by Socrates, that's all right. Now, which is here, it looks rather more like a call for help or an expression of uncertainty than the opposite. But this would need some more consideration. Now let us go on here. So we repeat, he doesn't know what sophistry is, and he wants to hand over his soul to a sophist, which is a risky thing. Yes?
Then I proceeded to say, "Well, but are you aware of the danger which you are running in submitting your soul to him? If you were going to commit your body to someone who might do good or harm to it, would you not carefully consider and ask the opinion of your friends and kindred and deliberate many days as to whether or not you should give him the care of your body? But when the soul is in question, which you hold to be of far more value than the body, and upon the good or evil of which depends the well-being of your all, then you never consult it either with your father or with your brother, or with any one of us who are your companions, whether or not you should commit your own soul to this foreigner who has come. In the evening, as you say, you hear of him, and in the morning you go to him, never deliberating or taking the opinion of anyone as to whether you ought to entrust yourself to him or not. You have quite made up your mind that you must, by hook or by crook, be a pupil of Protagoras, and are prepared to expend all the property of yourself and of your friends in carrying out this determination, although, as you admit, you do not know him, and have never spoken with him, and you call him a sophist, but are manifestly ignorant of what a sophist is, and yet you are going to commit yourself to his keeping."
Yes. Now, that is a strong statement. He shows now that Hippocrates' notion is extremely rash. A long deliberation would be needed as to whether it would be wise to become a pupil of Protagoras, or for that matter of a sophist in general. Now, this deliberation does not take place in Socrates' conversation with Hippocrates. And the question arises, when or whether it will take place at all. You see here, when he spoke about the difference between body and soul, he spoke first in the case of the body, you would deliberate with your friends and kinsmen. Yeah? And then in the repetition, a few lines later, he says, father and brother, kinsmen, and we comrades. He does not use the word friends here. Now, in the case of the body, the friends are, or maybe, more competent than father and brother, obviously. The friends may have medical education and father and brother may lack it, and this is in no way a disqualification of father and brother. In the case of the soul, however, father and brother are more competent than their comrades, are they? One thing is clear, father and brother, generally speaking, will be more concerned with the well-being than the comrades. Now, this greater concern would be decisive if there were no art called medicine of the soul. Then the greater concern would be decisive. But if there is an art, medicine of the soul, which the comrades have and father and brother have not, you would, of course, listen more to the comrades than to father and brother. But that is entirely an open question. You see here how Socrates appeals to the prejudice of Hippocrates, that stranger, which is, that it has, of course, a plausible meaning. You know him less than you would know a fellow citizen in a relatively small city. Yes?
When he heard me say this, he replied, "No other inference, Socrates, can be drawn from your words." I proceed.
Yeah, what does this mean? You see, he literally, and he having heard, you said, Now, this, I believe, never occurred before. There were two characterizations of his replies before. In the first place, 310d4, he said, laughed, having fallen to laugh. And in 312a2, having fallen to blush. First laughing, and then blushing, and now listening. Now, it is clear, listening is a more serious reaction, a more intellectual reaction, than a laughing or blushing. It is, the sequence is, as we can say, perfectly logical. First he is self-assured, laughs, then he blushes, and now, between the two extremes, he listens. In this part of the hypocritical section, which we began today, towards the end, there are no longer any oaths. Now, generally speaking, I could not prove that. Now I'm speaking from recollection. The oaths increase the in such works as Plato's Dialogues with the bantering character of the conversation. The more serious, the less oaths. That is, I mentioned this in passing. Now go on, Mr. Rankin.
I proceeded. Is not a sophist, Hippocrates, a person who deals wholesale or retail in such wares as provide food for the soul? I, for one, think that that is the kind of person he is. And what, Socrates, is the food of the soul? Surely, I said, knowledge is the food of the soul.
Yeah, literally, but not well translated, pieces of learning, because it's a plural. Huh? Pieces of learning. What would be the way, I mean, where you can build, you cannot say knowledge is learnings.
Doesn't it mean almost?
You can perhaps say
doctrines.
Yeah, doctrines, you can say. Yeah. Dogmas would be misleading, matimas. That's all right, the pluralism. Yes?
Is this sort of another step of that first progression you mentioned, whereas first he compared a sophist to a, you know, someone Hippocrates might want to go to become like, a sculptor or a doctor,
yeah,
and then to someone who might educate, but Hippocrates wouldn't want to become like, and now just to a merchant, which would be lower down than...
Yeah, sure, yeah. It would be common to that. After all, there is a question, how can you call a sophist... retail or wholesale merchant, that we must see. Now let us finish this section.
And we must take care, my friend, that the sophist does not deceive us when he praises what he sells, like the dealers, wholesale or retail, who sell the food of the body. For they praise indiscriminately all their goods, without knowing what is really beneficial or hurtful for the body. Neither do their customers know, with the exception of a trainer or physician who may happen to buy of them. In like manner, those who carry about the wares of knowledge and make the round of the cities and offer or retail them to any customer who wants them, praise them all alike. Though I should not be surprised, my dear fellow, if some of them, too, did not know which of their goods have a good and which a bad effect upon the soul. And their customers are equally ignorant, unless he who buys of them happens to be a physician of the soul.
Yes. Now, Socrates states now what a sophist is. Hitherto it was said it is dangerous to become a pupil of a sophist, since we do not know what a sophist is. Yeah. Now it is dangerous to become a pupil of the sophist, since we do know what a sophist is, at least to some extent. At any rate, Socrates knows. The sophists are sellers of soul food, and therefore are as incompetent judges of its goodness and as dishonest as the sellers of body food. Now, why are they called sellers, retail or wholesale? Yes?
Because they charge for the lesson.
That is, yeah, you know, that is surely one important point. But also, After all, if a farmer brings grain to the market, he would also sell, would he not? Yes.
They didn't make up all their ideas.
They did not produce the doctrines which they sell. In Greek, they are not autogoi, not the men who themselves produce the things, but they sell the wares produced by other people. And that is a very severe charge against the Sophists, that they are not, quote, original, unquote. They get their stuff from other people. Yes. And I think, otherwise, I believe the comparison is whether it is right or wrong, or fair or unfair, is another matter. But it's, I think, perfectly clear. Or do you have any difficulties? Now, hitherto, Socrates has only stated what Sophists have in common with the sellers of body food. And therefore, the situation is as grave in both cases. But although we know that most people at all times don't have a sufficient trust in their experience and in the kind of honesty of the body food sellers, that they don't have any great chances. Now Socrates will say that to buy body food is infinitely less dangerous than to buy soul food. This he will explain in the sequel. Yes?
If you know which of his wares are good...
No, I would like to mention only one point here, which I forgot. If he does not happen to be a physician of the regarding the soul, here he mentions only the physician, not the trainer, as you see. And generally speaking, gymnastics of the soul is not a very common term. Medicine of the soul has become a very common term throughout the ages. Now, why this emphasis on the restoring of health rather than the building up of the health of the soul? What does this imply? Yes?
In the gorgeous, that was the lower thing.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, but still, how come, I mean...
Abstraction from philosophy.
Does this mean? Medicine of the soul. And there is no gymnastics of the soul. This implication. Yes?
Maybe it can't be done. Maybe you can't train.
Yeah, now, it's not the more obvious explanation that the soul is by nature sick, and therefore what you need is medicine of the soul rather than gymnastics of the soul? This is not entirely far-fetched. In the Republic, 341c following, Socrates contrasts the goodness of the art of medicine with the badness of the human body. And he also says that the art of medicine is related to the human body as sight is to the eyes, just as the eyes reach their full actuality by the act of sight. The body reaches its full actuality by means of the art of medicine. One could say art, generalizing one word, is a natural perfection of an imperfect nature. And this is a thought which is rich in implications, because at the end of this thought, it carries through is nature is bad, and everything depends on man's doing, especially art. And so, this only in part. But it is not an accident, I believe, that medicine of the soul and not gymnastics of the soul has become the term for philosophy from a practical point of view throughout the ages. Yes?
If you know which of his wares are good and which are evil, you may safely buy knowledge of Protagoras or of anyone. But if not, then, my friend, watch out. Don't take risks. Don't gamble with the most precious.
I'm sorry.
With the most precious thing you have.
Yes. Now, Socrates reminds Hippocrates delicately of the fact that Hippocrates is utterly incompetent to judge of the worth of Protagoras' merchandise. This is a sign of Socrates' urbanity, which we see always. There is only one exception, not in Plato, as far as I know, but in Xenophon. Xenophon reposes himself, that Socrates called him in a given situation, you fool and you wretch, which he did not in any other case. But of course, Socrates in Aristophanes' class is always very harsh and never urbane. This only in passing. Yes, now let us continue.
For there is far greater risk in buying knowledge than in buying food and drink.
Yeah, let us say doctrines to keep the as a plural. Yeah. Yes.
Than in buying bits of food and drink. The one you purchase of the wholesale or retail dealer and carry them away in other vessels. And before you receive them into the body as food or drink, you may deposit them at home and call in an expert to give you advice, who knows what is good to be eaten and drunk, and what not, and how much, and when. Then the risk of purchasing them is not so great. But you cannot buy doctrines and carry them away in another vessel. When you have paid for them, you must receive them into the soul and go on your way, either greatly harmed or greatly benefited.
Yes. Here we see, to buy food of the, for the soul is infinitely more dangerous than to buy food for the body. He mentions paying the price only in the case of the soul food, because soul food, in addition to all other difficulties, is also much more expensive than body food, especially if you think of the simplest thing like water and bread. You see here also a transition at the beginning of the passage from food to food and drink. So this draws our attention to drink in particular. What could be the connection between Protagoras' merchandise and drink? Yes?
Well, drink can free you from certain inhibitions you might have had.
Water? I see certain kinds of drink.
Yes.
So in other, yeah, in, what does it, what is the immediate effect of this this kind of drink you spoke
of? Things other than water can loosen your mind and
yeah, but what is the first effect? I mean, as a broad effect, how do you
talk?
No, more immediately. It's a broad effect of
drink.
No,
it's
how do you intoxicating drinks, we say. Now, Protagoras intoxicates you. That we shall see as a gift of charming, of intoxicating people. Yes. And of course, the emphasis on drinks is, I think, also implied in the mere use of vessels. Many kinds of food you can carry away without having vessels, obviously, but you cannot take away liquids without vessels. And here the vessel is your own soul. And so the effect of your soul is immediate, whereas the effect of the body food depends entirely on when you will eat it and where you. You don't have to inflict it on your body immediately. Yes. Good.
These things let us investigate with our elders, for we are still young, too young to determine such a matter. And now let us go, as we were intending, and hear Protagoras. And when we have heard what he has to say, we may impart it to others. For not only is Protagoras at the house of Callias, but there is Hippias of Elis, and if I am not mistaken, Prodicus of Chaos, and several other wise men.
Sorry, I misled that. Now let me see. I'm sorry. Yes, now we must deliberate as to whether it is wise or safe to become Protagoras' pupil, the reason given. This deliberation does not take place now between Hippocrates and Socrates, because the implication being that they are incompetent to make this deliberation. And yet, here's something very surprising. What do? They have not deliberated, and what do?
They go just the same.
What does that mean? I mean, in the following the remark of Socrates. Yes?
he must know himself, Socrates must be in some
way. No, I mean they do not deliberate. And Socrates has warned them of the terrific danger. Yes?
For Socrates, I suppose, doesn't expect to plead his case in such a way that Protagoras immediately accept Socrates.
Yeah, but that we do not know. I mean, that it means another gamble because we cannot know.
They walk right into the lion's mouth?
Absolutely. In other words, despite the danger, Socrates exposes Hippocrates to the sole food or sole drink of Protagoras. Obviously, because they cannot know whether Protagoras will say, today there will be no food, we will discuss only the salary or the honorarium, however you call it. Socrates, after all, could simply have refused to introduce Hippocrates to Protagoras. Simply said, that's too dangerous for you, my boy, and I will not be responsible for you being corrupted by that stranger sophist. Why does Socrates not do this? Why does he expose him to Protagoras? Yes?
Well, this way he can do it in such a way that Protagoras won't seem so wise, i.e. if Socrates can beat him in an argument, then Hippocrates
won't. Yes, so can debunk it.
Yeah.
That is one way, yes. That is a possible answer, but that means, of course, that Socrates has very great self-confidence.
Yeah.
Yeah? And has taken the measure of Protagoras and can do it. What did you want to say, Mr. Schiffer?
I wanted to ask, why is it that Socrates says that we are still rather young to do this? Includes him.
Yeah, sure. He's not competent. They must both deliberate with people wiser than they.
Well, the question is, are older people really wiser than Socrates?
Yeah, well, this is always a question, but we have to take nevertheless literally. They will deliberate with other people. Now, here, with whom can they possibly deliberate? Because immediately after he said this, he says, then after having heard, yeah, we will also communicate with others. For not only Protagoras is there, but also Hippias and Prodicus. Does this not suggest that they will deliberate with two other sophists there? We do not, because there is some deliberation with them which takes place. Yes, but that we do not know. The deliberation about wisdom, the wisdom of becoming Protagoras' pupil, will take place perhaps within the dialogue itself. What you meant about the debunking is of course also but also a form of deliberation. When he speaks here of these two other sophists, he mentions Hippias first, and then the case of Prodicus, he adds, I believe also Prodicus. In other words, this is weakened. He's not so sure in the case of Prodicus. Prodicus happened to be the sophist closest to Socrates, that we know, for example, from Aristophanes' Clouds. And that is very interesting. We have a Platonic dialogue called Protagoras, as we see. There are two dialogues called Hippias, and there is no dialogue called Prodicus. That is curious. We will take this up later, after we have made the acquaintance of these gentlemen. Now let me, here we are at the end of the Hippocrates section. We have learned here that the whole discussion with Protagoras takes place for the sake of Hippocrates. We can say in order to prevent the corruption of Hippocrates by Protagoras. Whereas the whole discussion with Gorgias takes place for the sake of Gorgias and not directly to prevent his corruption. He's too old for that, but still in other way to improve it. The theme of the Protagoras seems to be higher than that of the Gorgias, if sophistry is indeed higher than rhetoric. The level of treatment is lower in the Protagoras than in the Gorgias. Now the character for the sake of whom the conversation with Protagoras takes place is of course different from the characters to whom the conversation is narrated. The comrade, you had difficulties in understanding? Pardon? I mean, what I said was extremely simple. I may have expressed it clumsily. The there is a character or characters to whom the conversation with Protagoras is narrated. It's a comrade at the beginning. And then there is a character for the sake of whom the conversation with Protagoras takes place. Now, and let us look at this character now for the sake of whom the conversation takes place. He is quite young. He is manly, vehement, swears frequently. He is more tinged by, quote, intellectualism, unquote, than the comrade. He knows much earlier of the arrival of such a star as Protagoras and others. And he is very egotistical. We have seen how he behaved towards Socrates in that bedroom. While eager for things new and strange, he is, however, under the spell of the old prejudices. Never would he become a sophist, for example. Socrates does not try to cure him as he tried to cure the comrade by an appeal to Homer or other traditional authorities. Now, this brief conversation with Hippocrates is, as I stated before, the central conversation within the dialogue. It is the only conversation which takes place in strict privacy. One man talking to one man, in Greek, monos pros monon. It is the only dialogue which exists, which takes place in the privacy of Socrates' house, not to say of his bedroom. Remember, some of you will remember another bedroom scene of which we learn in the Platonic dialogues. Pun? That is also in a way true, yes, in a way. But that is a special bedroom in jail. Yeah? That's quite true, but a more famous one. Alcibiades' report about his sleeping with Socrates at the end of the banquet. But you are quite right, the Crito is very important. But as was pointed out to me after the last meeting by some of you, the situation is very different in the Crito. Crito enters Socrates' bedroom in the very early morning without awakening him. And Hippocrates, you know, Socrates should sleep. For the short time he has to live, he should not be exposed to the agony of death. Whereas Hippocrates, of course, awakens him because he comes with good news. Yes, we can leave it at that. This much I wanted to say about this central conversation, although it, in external terms it is rather eccentric, rather close to the beginning. Is there any point you would like to raise in connection with what we have discussed now? Now we turn to the bulk of the dialogue. Yes?
How would anybody be able to find out what the doctrines of a sophist were without exposing himself to the danger of learning them from a sophist?
That's a good question. But still, you can perhaps go by very crude criteria. For example, if you know that it is improper to study things in heaven or beneath the earth, and then you find out this sophist does study things in heaven or the earth, it's clear, yeah? Isn't that simple? Or if he would say, there is nothing just by nature, all justice is conventional, could you not on the basis of this say, I don't want to have anything to do with him, and at least I don't want to have my immature children to have anything to do with him? How do people go about in choosing teachers for their children? I mean, there are some cases which have come to the public record. The professor in, where was it, in Indiana or in Illinois, who gave uncalled for advice to co-eds, you've heard of it. Well, I suppose quite a few parents would say, on the basis of this mere fact, that is not a good teacher of girls. And I said, and so? Well, I mean, I don't see a great difference. You asked a broad question in the most general terms. I give you a very general answer. Or would you wish to make your question more specific?
Socrates initially expresses the danger of going to a sophist in terms of not knowing anything of the doctrines that the sophist will propound.
Yeah.
This is not the same thing as knowing perhaps one doctrine of a professor believing that this
That's
one
true.
Doctrine disqualifies it.
Yeah, but all right, how would you behave as a father in such a way? Do not know whether the merchandise is healthy or unhealthy for your child. What would you do?
Well, I would be inclined to go see myself.
Uh-huh. In other words, you would not do what Socrates does, namely expose him, his soul, to that possibly unhealthy, maybe fatal merchandise.
Well, I'm skeptical that doctrines can, in and of themselves, do damage if there is someone available to refute them. I don't see that there's anything unreasonable about Socrates' conduct. What I see as somewhat unreasonable is Socrates' insistence on the dangers to Hippocrates of their going off to see Protagoras in the first place.
Yeah, well, you see, I know your view is familiar to me. I mean, that no doctrine can be dangerous because, how was it called? The free market, also market, of ideas, and the good cause will be victorious. But can it not do some harm while it is not yet deflated? And secondly, how important is the reputation regarding its effect? There are many refuted doctrines who are still very active. I mean, quite a few people have refuted Marxism, both in its original and more recent forms, but you must admit this is much less efficient than the armament of this country. In other words, are men as rational as you presuppose? That's a simple question. That a doctrine, by virtue of having been refuted, ceases to be powerful.
But it's a question of who delivers the refutation and when. If Hippocrates went off to Protagoras and heard a dangerous doctrine and wrongly believed it, and then some 6 months later chanced to hear a refutation of it from somebody that he didn't particularly trust anyway, then this refutation would have no effect. In this particular case, if Socrates is going along with him, he obviously has a considerable trust in Socrates, and Socrates would be able to refute it immediately if a refutation were called for.
Yeah, that is in a way what happens. So that, yeah, but the other question is, however, this: you say he has considerable trust in Socrates, but he does not for one moment think that Socrates could give him supply with good soul food. So how great can that trust in Socrates be? He regards Socrates as a man benevolent to him, and whose to his advice he would listen within limits, but not as a wise man. If Socrates were were sensitive to the least degree, he would be could very well feel offended that he knows him for a long time and does not for one moment consider him a wise man, whereas he regards Protagoras, that star, of course, as a wise man on the basis of his star-like appearance. But I think the question of principle which you raise, there is no doctrine, however wrong, which can do harm to the soul, is exactly the problem here. That is what divides most of us from Plato and other men, that they thought there are dangerous doctrines. And the now prevailing view is there are no dangerous doctrines. Yeah? To state it simply and honestly, that is a great question which we must face, but we cannot. That's exactly the reason why we read such books, in order to look at our fundamental premises from the other side. We may arrive at the conclusion, it says perfectly open, that the now prevailing view is correct. But then we will understand our view much better after having gone through that operation than if we simply continue what we have thought before without testing it. Is it not wise? And that is very good you brought this up. Mr. Shulsky?
Can we use the analogy to drink here to say that perhaps what Protagoras is going to teach won't simply be a matter of doctrines, but or won't, you know, won't be simply a question of doctrines which have a value for their truth, but which will be something in the way of become something in the way of an appetite for one reason or another.
Let us make a distinction between unimportant doctrines and important doctrines. An unimportant doctrine about the intestines of worm. Yeah? This cannot possibly corrupt anyone. But doctrines about good and bad, justice and injustice, do not have this character. And obviously, Protagoras is so much in demand because he teaches interesting things, important, and not unimportant. Mr. Brill?
Does the fact that Socrates is willing to lead Hippocrates into this danger raise the question of what we discussed originally about whether this is an involuntary or involuntary discussion? Because it would, if Protagoras was at all difficult of access, then Socrates would come having a bait and would having a possible student.
Yeah, whether that, we do not know enough of that. This would presuppose that Socrates had never seen Protagoras before. And I don't disclose a secret to you when I tell you he had seen Protagoras before. So this coming to Protagoras in the company of Hippocrates radically differs from other conversations Socrates had with Protagoras where no such bait was brought with him. Proper, yes.
One reason you gave that gentleman over there for reading in Plato, Plato's
great... Or such books in general, yeah.
Reading them from the point of view today is to get a counterweight or another view of, from our opinion on certain matters. So understand our opinion better than our beliefs. Why do we have to read other people's books to understand our opinions better?
Well, because do you know of anyone today who states the other view, the alternative to the views now prevailing, as forcefully as a great man of the past?
But do we have to hear another argument, know our own argument as well?
But the question is, I mean, there are some people who are doubtful of the soundness of, say, of Dewey's, John Dewey's. But whether these men have the power of presenting that alternative view and this insight into all the important ramifications which men of the magnitude of Plato have, that is, I think, a question which I believe is not a serious question. Because I would say I have some experience, but I think there is no one there who can be compared.
But for those who really understand themselves well, like for John Locke, for instance, he needn't have read anything by Plato or Aristotle. It's only those who are somewhat inferior.
That is not quite true. How does John Locke call his peculiar approach to the fundamental questions?
How does he begin it?
How does John Locke call his approach to the fundamental questions? But he doesn't say it in one of the better known works, I happen to know it, The Way of Ideas. And he traces that to Descartes. Yeah, but who began to speak in a very audible way of ideas? So I believe one has to know Plato if one wants to understand what the Cartesian Lockean way of ideas is. And one could show it in any other way. Locke himself, you see, you cannot understand him sufficiently if you do not know, surely Firmat, and also Hooker, Richard Hooker. So that is merely, that is a very simple question in principle. One has to know the, as I stated in other courts in which I will be there present, the so-called quarrel of the ancient and moderns. We are driven back to it again and again. Therefore, there is no, it's not a serious difficulty. Do you want to say?
You mentioned a moment ago in answering one of these other questions, posing a question of what the father does when he's introducing his son to a new danger. I wonder if there is a possibility here that Socrates regards himself in the realm of ideas as the father of Hippocrates in a certain sense, and that he considers that when a father is going to introduce his son to a dangerous thing, he may do it in a way which is consonant with the nature of the son. For example, Hippocrates is an impulsive and courageous, manly, masculine individual. So Socrates could consider that if he simply said, no, these are dangerous doctrines, that Hippocrates might be perverse enough to go anyway.
No, he couldn't. He wouldn't know any of that's clear. The only link with Protagoras is Socrates. That's the implication. This won't do. But what is this? Your question reminds me of a classic discussion, much earlier than Dewey, and that is Milton's Areopagitica. And he takes issue with the cautious posture of the ancient writers. And he says fundamentally we must be exposed to all kinds of evil to be truly good. And he speaks of cloistered virtue as something which is not good, not real virtue, which is not exposed. Yeah, well, if you read the Areopagitica, I'm sure some of you will have read it, because it's one of the most very early and famous document for complete freedom of discussion. If you think through this argument, it would simply mean that the best thing to bring up children is in a street in which the majority of houses are houses of ill repute. Now, Milton, of course, did not mean that, and I believe no sane man ever meant it, but it, nevertheless, you see, there are some limits. I mean, there is at least a certain stage in the development in which our education must be cloistered. And the question is how long this takes. I mean, whether 8 years is the end, or 14 years, or maybe, as the ancients said, in the case of many men, the whole life. That is a great question. Mr. Marlin.
As far as Socrates deciding to go to talk to Protagoras with Hippocrates, as we said, as Jade, is there a possibility, at least, that Socrates here is saying to himself, well, that he's fairly sure that what will come out of the discussion will convince Hippocrates that Protagoras has nothing to offer. But in any case, what's important to me as a thinking man is not so much the opportunity to do something morally good for another person, as the opportunity to have, since I'm a young man still learning, an intellectual or intelligent discussion with another person.
This is only a repetition of an argument where you see that Socrates could have gone to Protagoras any time without...
Yes, but perhaps because Hippocrates is there, Protagoras is now more willing to spend time with this young Socrates.
Yeah, but is Socrates so busy that he could not go there except if he has such a practical reason? We know Socrates is not busy at all. He does nothing but talk.
Not so much as Socrates busy, but is Hippocrates being used merely as bait to get Socrates into a good discussion with Protagoras?
Yeah, that is a question which we cannot now answer, but because we must see how things develop. So we do not know. Now, Mr. Glenn, that will be the last question now. Yes.
What is the justification, if there is this tension that exists between the pursuit of understanding on the one hand and the possibility and the necessity for studying evil doctrine on the other hand? What is the justification for the pursuit of wisdom? Perhaps we should just take our chances with beneficent falsehoods.
No, that is not the point, but the question is whether someone like the slave hunting Hippocrates, a young, very, say, boy of 16, 17, has a nature and the preparation for the pursuit of wisdom. That's it. So, now let us go on where we left off.
To this we agreed, and proceeded on our way until we reached the vestibule of the house, and there we stopped, in order to conclude, before entering the house, a discussion which had arisen between us as we were going along. And we stood talking in the vestibule until we had finished and come to an understanding.
Yes, now let us stop here. So there is here a conversation between Socrates and Hippocrates which is not reported, as you see. And we draw from this a simple and trivial conclusion that not every logos, not every conversation is disclosed. They complete that logos while standing. Standing is emphasized. They do no longer walk. Now, there is the difference between what you do standing and what you do walking. I think you know this from your own experience. You are more concentrated when you stand than when you walk. You talk to someone, and then at the moment you don't go on because you need a greater concentration, and the greater movement of the body, which is implied in walking, would be detrimental to the movement of the mind. Coming to a stand after movement is acquiring the concept of the thing in question. Read Aristotle's Posterior Analytics in the end. Now, there is a contrast with this conversation comes to an end, and the conversation with Protagoras, which follows, is in a way incomplete. There is also a classic passage about standing in a vestibule in the beginning of the banquet, Plato's banquet. And Alcibiades also refers to Socrates standing in silent meditation in the banquet 220c. But in the banquet, Socrates stands in the vestibule of the neighboring house, not in the house. Why? Because the house of Agathon, to which they go for the banquet, is open. And it would be very embarrassing to be seen from the house standing there, whereas here, as we shall see, the house to which they go now is very much closed. This similarity between the Protagoras and the banquet is important, as we shall see later. The personnel of the Protagoras is to a large extent identical with the personnel of the banquet. What that means is another matter. Now let us go on.
And I think that the doorkeeper, who was a eunuch,
Search yourself. Pardon? Yeah, surely, that is no question. But you must not is the point. What does Rousseau understand by freedom? Now, part of it is simply that understanding of freedom which also Hobbes and Locke have. You cannot preserve yourself if you are not free to acquire the means of your self-preservation. And if you are not free to judge of what is conducive to self-preservation, that is a certain notion of freedom. Aristotle only thinks that it's not enough, because as he puts it, when enter the city for the sake of mere life, but the city exists for the sake of the good life. And the true meaning of freedom would be in terms of the good life, not of means for mere life. Now Rousseau also has a somewhat more lofty notion of freedom, but how it is related to this Hobbesian, that's not easy to answer. Mr. Müller?
Well, those who, I guess, in some way live outside of the society, those who are less than man or
more than
man.
Yeah, well, less than men, those who are completely, who are so psychopathological, so moronic, there are such people. And on the other hand, there would be people who would not need society because they are in the highest respect self-sufficient. He did not elaborate it, what he meant, but he meant by the philosophers. But in a simple sense, of course, it cannot be true because they do need food, shelter, and other things.
What about the ones who are lower?
And
what about the ones who are lower?
What can you do with it?
Is there anything that corresponds to that class or body?
I think Rousseau would admit that they are idiots. Sure. He would admit that. Mr. Schrock, I neglected one.
I don't have too much clarity on what the problem of democratic rule is in Rousseau. It seems to me that you're suggesting that the Emile might be an ideal type, but an impossible suggestion of how the democratic man might be, or the average man, might be made rational. If that were possible, that is, if every man could have one tutor and so forth. But perhaps the Emile could be have a lower aim rather than making all men capable of exercising rationality in the assembly as in the social contract. Perhaps the Emile might be a suggestion of how to make a few men, a few average men, leaders. And
I think that's it.
Page 126, where he says that Emile is made to lead, to rule his fellows.
Yes. Yeah, but that is very simple. I mean, I can explain that. Rousseau makes a distinction between the sovereign and the government. And an explicit distinction, it is very rare that this distinction is made as clearly prior to him. The sovereign is not the governor. So in the ancient democracies, the sovereign was the government. The sovereign people did not make laws. It also deliberated about war and peace. And made war and peace, and of course judged in the law courts. The distinction between sovereign and government means that the executive and judicial actions are not actions of the people as people, but actions of individuals commissioned by the people. And this must be so if there is to be a reason, wisdom, and justice in society, according to Rousseau. And therefore, so the government is radically different from the sovereign. And by the way, that is underlying, of course, the American Constitution, because the sovereign people delegate these and these powers to the executive, legislative, and so on. Good.
He would be government.
Sure, and perhaps even more than that. I mean, perhaps even a legislator for all of you know. And that is unlikely. But surely government.
Many ways to give our minds recreation from labor by public and daily life wherever we expel sadness. We have this farther by the greatness of our city that all things from all parts of the earth are imported hither.